bed at the centre of the room. Vida was struck by the lack of decoration in this room. It seemed to have been partitioned from one much larger. The grand height of its ceiling was out of proportion with its meagre floor space and single narrow window. Intricate plaster mouldings, once gold-leafed but now faded and peeling, were interrupted by new walls. The furniture was plain, and even the bed was narrow. It looked more like a servant's attic room than a master's private chamber. "Ah, Miss Carew," Zecca said. "I would like you to ask this man, I forget his name, the one who attends the gentleman. You mean Billings? Yes, he. Please ask him when he found his master and what medicines Lord Pemberton has taken." Billings, pale and looking fixedly at the bed, was holding the back of a chair as if he would fall without it. She relayed this question. He seemed to take a moment to tear his attention from the prone figure of his master, then answered, "I found him on the floor. I thought he had just fallen from the bed, but I could not rouse him. I thought he was..." "What medicine has he taken?" Zecca repeated. Vida translated. "Only his usual sleeping medicine," Billings replied. "In heaven's name, what drug is in this medicine?" Vida translated this question, but Billings only shrugged. "Laudanum. I'll give him 30 drops in milk." "Where is the bottle?" "I've thrown it away," Billings said. "It was empty, so I took it downstairs." "Tell him it is important that I have this bottle so that I can try to confirm the constituents of any remains in it." "I have another bottle," Billings said. He opened a cupboard and produced a blue bottle. Its cork was sealed with wax. "Does it not have a label?" "I took it off. It's the same one I always use." "But the label tells the dosage." "I've seen them enough times. I just take the labels off." Zecca turned back to the patient whose pulse he had been taking during this exchange. He lifted the sleeping man's eyelids and put his ear down to listen to his chest. "You stay, if you please, Miss Carew. Everyone else should leave." Vida conveyed this instruction to the room, and the footman left immediately. Billings did not move. "Tell the man Billings to go to the bottle store and search for the empty bottle. It is vitally important that it should be found." Billings protested at this. "It's in a large box of bottles. I just tossed it in. I won't be able to find it." "He can find it if he tries. He can ask the other footmen to help him. But he must find it immediately," Zecca said. Billings, even after this was translated, seemed unwilling to move. "Billings, do as you are told." Lady Felicity spoke for the first time. She had slipped into the room and was standing by the door. Billings hesitated another moment, then hurried away. "I shall make sure he is thorough and given help. Vida, you stay with the doctor." Lady Pemberton followed Billings, taking the back stairs. "I am glad she has gone for a few moments. Here, Vida, help me to raise his head. I want to use some harder methods to try to restore his consciousness." Zecca then slapped the cheek of the sleeping man, whose head rolled to one side under the blow. There was no other response. Zecca changed sides and slapped the patient again, harder this time. "Lord Pemberton, come back. Wake up now," he shouted into the patient's lolling ear. "It looks unreasonably violent," he told Vida, "but I can assure you it is the recognized way. He is not completely unconscious. There are reflexes. I want to keep him as wakeful as I can. We do not know what he has taken, though I imagine it is a sleeping draught of the usual concoction, with opium and so on. If he has taken too much, he is in danger of falling asleep and not reawakening. We will do our best to rouse him. Vida, pinch his toe, please. Yes, pinch it hard. The big toe. Try the other one. We must try to keep him awake." With the gentlest knock, Swain appeared at the door. He took in what was happening to his master with the slightest flicker of alarm, but remained composed. "Ask him for a bucket of cold water and some ice, if it can be found," Zecca said. And once this was translated, Sweyn immediately disappeared again. The German doctor continued to shout and slap the patient. If we can rouse him, we stand a chance of getting him to drink something to dilute what he has taken. Vita hated to see the rough treatment being delivered to the helpless sleeping man. Lord Pemberton's face was a nasty grey, and his neck completely lacked the strength to hold his head, which rolled and flopped with every blow. His breath was ragged and unsteady. "Pinch his cheek, Miss Carew. Call to him. He must not slip away." Sweyn returned with a bucket of cold water. They soaked towels in it and placed them on the patient's chest and forehead. Zeka, with Swain's help, attempted to get him to swallow a little water, but he was too unresponsive to do so, falling limp as a rag doll back onto the pillow each time. Lady Pemberton returned to the room. "The men are all searching for the bottle. They should find it soon." If she was alarmed by what she saw, she did not show it. "Tell her ladyship that her voice may help to rouse him. She should call to him and order him to wake up," Zeka instructed. "Dickie, my darling, I want you to wake up now," Felicity told him. "Wake up and look at us, Dickie. Wake up. We need you with us now." Still the head lolled on the pillow, the cheeks now reddened by the slapping they had received, but otherwise the face still a corpse-like waxy grey. Felicity seemed at a loss for a brief moment. She sat back in a chair and looked miserably around at the butler, the doctor and Vita, but then stood up with new determination and walked to the sick man's bedside. Chapter 40. "You shall not leave us, Dickie. I forbid it. You have a wife and children who need you. You shall not desert us. I will not permit you to slip away. I will not allow it. We want you here. You have removed yourself from us for quite long enough over the years. You shall not neglect your duties now. You must wake up and speak to us and return to your family. You are needed, Dickie. Wake up." To the astonishment of all, she then picked up the bucket and dashed the rest of the contents over her husband's unconscious form. Whether it was his wife's tone of voice, the shock of the very cold water, or the loud crash of the empty bucket hitting the floor, there was a distinct, if muted, response from the patient. He coughed twice, and his hands flexed. "Quickly, we must continue to stimulate him," Zeka told Vita. "Pump his arms." They raised and lowered the man's arms rapidly, as if he were swimming a backstroke. Vita imagined that there was a marginally different muscle tone now, but she could not be certain. "It was a noise that woke him, wasn't it?" Lady Felicity said, and jumping to her feet again, she picked up the bucket and threw it with all her strength against the brass rail at the foot of the bed, making an ear-splitting noise. In the echoing silence that followed, the patient's breathing changed its rhythm. "You see? He heard that. Perhaps it was the cold water. Swain, please bring some more." Frantic, she picked the empty bucket up and held it out to the butler, who glanced for confirmation at Dr. Zeka. "I shall need Swain to help lift him to his feet," Zeka said. With the help of the women, they hauled the still unconscious man to the edge of the bed. Then Swain on one side and Zeka on the other took an arm over their shoulder and lifted him upright. Slowly they began dragging him, feet trailing behind, across the room. He seemed almost as lost to them as before, but something indefinable had changed. Felicity walked ahead, and when they paused, she spoke fiercely to him as before. He must not sleep. He must not abandon his family. His children needed him. She needed him. The house could not run without him. He must wake up. By the time the slow circuit of the room was completed, the patient seemed to attempt to lift his head. They heard him mutter something and cough. His bare feet struggled to cooperate in the forced walking. He was beginning to regain consciousness. Within an hour, he had taken a little water and could answer a simple question, but keeping him awake was still difficult, and Zeka did not want to risk him drifting off again. So they took it in turns to dip cloths in cold water, pinch his toes, slap his cheeks, or make noises loud enough to prevent it. Tom and Daniel, both called away from other work, were searching the cellar bottle store with Billings. "You sure you put it in this one?" Tom said, looking at the mounded contents of one of the large crates of discarded bottles they had emptied onto the flagstone floor. "I just threw it," Billings told them. "How should I know which one it went in?" "Why does that German doctor want it, anyhow?" Daniel asked. "Don't ask me," Billings said with a shrug. "He thinks you gave the master something bad, I reckon." Tom said this, straightening up and looking Billings in the eye. "Don't be daft," Billings said. "Did you?" "Did I what?" "Give his lordship something that made him take sick like that?" "Course I bloody didn't." "Why do you hide the bottle then?" "I chucked it away. I never hid it. It was just the same medicine he always takes." The two young footmen looked severely at Billings. "He's lying," Daniel said. "He's a liar, and I reckon he does a bit of thieving too. He creeps around the maids. Now he's gone and poisoned the master." He moved behind Billings and closed the wooden door of the glass store. The click of its metal latch made the valet look round. "Here, what are you?" Without answering, Daniel punched Billings in the face. The valet fell to his knees among the broken glass on the floor, then struggled to stand but lost his footing and sprawled full length. Tom had not moved. He stood over Billings and said, "It'll be a lot worse than that if you don't find that bottle, won't it, Daniel?" "It will, and I'll enjoy doing it too. You're a nasty piece of work, Billings." Billings struggled to sit. He held up a hand, bleeding from several cuts. "You can't do this. The master will have you for this," he said. But his voice, high-pitched and fearful, only made them smile. "We'll finish the job if you don't find that bloody bottle." "It's in the corner over there," Billings muttered. He pointed to a corner away from the crates they had been emptying. A pile of sacking was folded there. "It's under that lot." Daniel went over and pulled the sacks aside. He pulled several small bottles out and held them up. "Why you go to the trouble of hiding them then, Billings?" he said, sniffing the empty bottles and examining them. "What have you been up to?" "Nothing. They're just the master's usual sleeping medicine." Daniel put several blue bottles into his pockets. "Much as I'd enjoy giving you a beating, we should get these bottles to the German doctor pretty quick," Tom said. "What should we do with Billings here?" Daniel asked, poking Billings in the back. "We could lock him in." "The lock's better on the swill room," said Daniel, sounding suddenly cheerful. "So it is. This way, then, Mr. Valet. You can have a nice little rest with the swill buckets." They grabbed Billings on each side and dragged him across the stone passage to the room full of stinking bins of pig food. Chapter 41. Rita looked from the yellow bedroom window along the avenue of trees that stretched into the distance. The children were moving about upstairs. You could hear them in the nursery playroom. Would they know more about Miss Hartley? Did anyone? The governess was little more than an inconvenience in her ill health and in her death. Something to be tidied away. After years of service, it was as easy to dispose of her as to throw away a chipped glass or cracked dish. She had returned to the yellow room to fetch a jacket. Pemberton was living up to its reputation for cold. But as she entered, she saw a note had been pushed beneath her door. She opened it and saw that it had come from Monsieur Picard. "Dear Miss Carew, I would be most obliged if you would meet me in the chef's pantry as soon as possible. Emile Picard." She heard footsteps approaching. One of the maids opened the door. "The German ladies are looking for you, miss. They're in the parlour." Monsieur Picard would have to wait a little longer. We are leaving, Vita. But we could not depart without saying goodbye to our little translator, could we, Adelina? Of course not. You have been such a comfort to us in this terrible time, Vita. We are so grateful. Miss von Diepenthal is well enough to travel now, I take it, Vita said. She is. Of course, she must lie down in the carriage, which means Dr. Zecker must travel separately, but he assures us she is strong enough for the journey. Please feel free to write to us, Vita, Tante Gabriele said. And if you should ever visit Germany, you must be our guest. Both the ladies nodded and smiled so enthusiastically that Vita could only agree. And we have a little thank you gift, Adelina added, handing her a package. It contained a signed handbill for one of Carlotta's concerts, which showed a charming drawing of the singer performing before a cheering crowd. And take a little advice from a lady who has seen something of the world, Vita, Gabriella continued. Make a little more of your appearance. Something could be done with the hair. And the eyeglasses, well, we have already discussed the eyeglasses. Vita smiled on. So the hair is found wanting too, she thought, after they had finally departed. William was leaning on the back of a sofa, looking out of the window in the long hall, when Vita passed on her way to the chef's basement room. Miss Hartley has died now, he told her as she approached. She was teaching me the piano yesterday, but now she has died. I'm sorry to hear that, William, Vita said. He took pity on the small solitary boy and paused to sit beside him. He rested his chin on his hands. I think she died of happiness, the boy said suddenly. He still did not look at her, but directed his remarks towards the window. Miss Hartley told me she would die of happiness if she heard the singing. I heard her in her room last night. I think she was dancing. You could hear the music a little bit, even in my room. It was nice music. Can someone die of happiness? Vita looked at the boy for a few moments, unable to formulate an answer. If that is what dying of happiness looks like, she thought, I hope I never see the body of someone who has died of misery and distress. They're going to send Nettie away too, William continued. I like her, but she keeps crying and crying. Mama says Mrs. Parks will have to send her away. Someone else will make tea for Marianne and me now and give us our medicine at bedtime. But a good thing is that I am going to go to school and Marianne too. We are glad about that. We will have lots of friends at school. My cousin is there. He says it's ripping good fun. I can take Blackstock, that's my pony. As the boy spoke, Vita saw the figure of Billings come up the stairs further along. Even from a distance, she could tell he was in a rage. His clothes were untidy and his movements clumsy. He saw her talking to William and turned in their direction. William, I want you to go and find Swain, please. Go now and ask him to come here as quickly as you can. Take the other staircase. Hurry, William. The boy looked confused for a moment, then hurried off. Chapter 42. Vita considered escaping herself, but Billings was already hailing her. It's you that got this started, he called. What's it to you anyway? You never even knew the governess. What's any of it got to do with you? I don't know what you mean, Vita told him, trying to keep her voice calm. He was a large man, red-faced in fury and ready to fight. As he approached, the rank smell of pig's will followed him. His jacket was ripped at the shoulder, and dried blood crusted at the corner of his mouth. Your German lies, that's what did it. German lies? What do you mean? Why do you write secrets in German, then? To hide things? Come with me, he said. He lunged, took her arm in a painful grip, and began to drag her to the main staircase. "Let me go," Vita said, trying to free her arm. But he was far stronger, hauling her up two flights and across a landing to a smaller stone stair beyond. Up these steps they continued, Vita's feet tripping and stumbling as they narrowed and twisted upward. An arched wooden door gave onto a stone turret room. Billings dragged Vita in, closed the door behind them, and leaned against it, panting. "Tell me what you wrote in those notes you made about the body. What did the doctor say? And why was it in German? What did they say killed her? She never did it, Mrs. Parks. She just found her and moved her. She never gave her medicine. I gave her medicine, but only the normal bottle she always had. It wouldn't kill her. That wasn't it." He was making no sense to Vita. She heard only an outpouring of incoherent words. "Why have you brought me here?" she asked, trying once again to speak quietly and sound as calm as she could. Billings turned and reached into a corner where a small wooden cupboard was fixed to the curving stone wall. He opened it with a key and showed her the contents, several rows of small blue bottles. "I keep them here. I wanted you to see them. They are not harmful. They are all the same. The chemist makes them for his lordship. I keep them here under lock and key, safe. I count the drops out. Same every night. It wasn't me that made his lordship ill. It wasn't me that killed Hartley. They both took this medicine. They liked it, and it did both of them good." "I know about Laudanum Billings. My mother took it. I gave it to her." "Then you know how sick people need it. It's a blessing to them. I've done nothing wrong. Whatever you wrote in your German, I've done nothing wrong, see?" He was angry again. "May I look at the bottles?" Vita asked. "They're all the same," he said. "Why did you remove their labels?" "I don't need to see them. It's always the same. Generally, I just take them off and put them in the fire." Vita stood up slowly. "Can I look?" she asked. "I want you to. That's why I brought you up here. You'll see I haven't done anything wrong. Look at them." The smell of him in the small circular room was almost overpowering. His clothes stank of old meat and rotting vegetables, and the sweat that was beading his face. Vita peered into the dark cupboard. At the very back, some bottles did still have brown labels tied to their necks. She reached in and pulled two of them out. "On that side, they're the new ones. I got them Friday," Billings told her. "That other one is older. I keep them in order. I take care. You can give it to babies. The chemist told me people give it to babies to help them sleep. It's well made, carefully mixed. I wouldn't give it to them otherwise. I'm helping them."
"How much does Lord Pemberton take?"
30 or 40 drops, sometimes a bit more. He asks for more."
"Billings, that is a great deal of this medicine. It says poisonous in excess."
"I know that," Billings said, annoyed. "He needs that much to take his pain off."
"These new bottles are a stronger mix than usual," Vita said. "It says it on the label here. They are twice as strong. If someone takes their normal dose, they are really taking twice as much as before."
"No, it's the same."
"It isn't the same, Billings."
"You're wrong. You're making it up. You and your German secrets, your lies. You'll lose me, my job."
A thought suddenly occurred to Vita. "Did you give any of this new batch to anyone else?"
"Only Nettie," he said.
"Nettie? The nursery maid? Why?"
"For the boy. He doesn't sleep well. He gets it at bedtime to send him off."
Vita felt her knees weaken beneath her at the thought of little William being dosed with this wretched medicine. Billings was quieter now.
He was struggling to take in the implications of the label on the small bottle in Vita's hand. Billings, it's very important that nobody gives this to William. Do you understand?
It won't harm him. You can give it to babies.
Not this kind. It's not mixed correctly. This is dangerous. Please let me go and...
It's not dangerous. I told you it's not dangerous.
Roused to sudden fury, he lunged towards Vita, grabbing at her collar, causing her glasses to fly from her face and fall to the stone floor. He pulled her towards him and hissed in her face,
I've done nothing wrong. You'll tell them and get me in trouble. I'll stop you. You're just a busybody. Nobody thinks you're clever, you and your German.
He was jerking her from side to side, his hot, rank breath on her face. He stamped a foot, and Vita distinctly heard the splinter of trampled spectacles.
Billings, please, the boy doesn't deserve to die.
He was holding her at the throat, her blouse twisted too tightly. She was beginning to feel the pressure of blood in her neck and face. He lost her footing, and the pressure grew even stronger as he put his hands around her neck, and twisting his face with the effort, began to squeeze. As she fell, Vita felt the valet pulled off balance. His grip was still tight and the pulse loud in her ears, but she summoned a surge of powerful determination at the thought of the children. She must protect the children from this medicine. She had to get to them. Scrabbling furiously, she kicked with all her strength, aiming for Billing's soft middle parts, repeatedly pounding her boot heels as viciously as she could. He roared. His grasp on her neck shifted. She was able to catch her breath, but he was still by far the stronger. The children, I must get to the children. Again, the thought pushed fear aside and brought Vita a new burst of strength. She reached towards the blur that was probably Billing's head, and grabbed for hair and ears. He shouted in pain again. There were other sounds too. Her own howls of effort and rage more than fear echoed around the circular stone room. It was exhausting work, this fighting, a distant part of her brain recorded. The children. Miss Hartley's thin dead corpse with its vacant death grin came to her again. William and Mary Ann must not take the drug, the one that must have killed their governess. Something was in her hand, a bottle. She grasped it and swung her fist as hard as she could towards her attacker's face. She felt the glass thud into his jaw.
Chapter 43. As she hit the cold stone floor, Vita heard the crash of the door thrown back and the shouts of several men. At first they seemed distant, as though her ears were full of water. She could see black shapes flailing and hear Billings bellow with rage. She was jerked to her feet, his arm now around her neck from behind, his voice close to her ear. He shouted, I'll kill her. I swear I'll kill her if you come any closer. Vita's struggle to breathe took all her energy. Her feet were barely on the ground, her neck was pulled back. She could smell the stink of rotten cabbage on the arm of Billings' jacket. Her mind swirled with the angry thought that there must be something she could do to defend herself, if only she could think. Billings, holding her like a shield between himself and the men, barged past them and dragged Vita behind him up the last flight of stairs to the top of the turret. It was twisting and narrow, too narrow for anyone to do more than follow. The small door at the top, which he barged with his shoulder, opened to an icy blast of air. They were at roof height, ahead only a narrow walkway between the steep slope of the hall's roof and the crumbling stonework of ancient battlements. Vita, resisting but breathless, and losing the focus of her thoughts, glimpsed the sheer drop of 50 feet to the wet gravel of the carriage drive below. Why are we here? She shouted, but her voice was muffled in the freezing air.
What do you want?
To keep you quiet, you and your lies, Billings growled. To shut you up for good and all.
There were shouts from the men giving chase.
Billings, let her go.
Down, get down, miss.
The men had reached the turret door. One was crawling onto the walkway. He had a stick. At first their words were lost, but Billings, shocked himself by the cold and the terrifying height, loosed his grip on Vita's neck for a fraction of a second. She gulped icy air. Out across the rooftop she glimpsed a wide view, rolling cloud and steely sleet-brown sky. The cold air cleared her mind. She fell to her knees, slipping through Billings' grip, and threw herself down along the walkway. It felt better to be lower than the parapet. In fury, Billings lunged forward, grabbing for her. The faces of the chasing footmen were pale behind him in the dark doorway. They shouted helpless warnings, but it was too late. Billings' feet scrabbled in the grit of broken stonework, and he lost his balance, flailing his arms and falling heavily across the low peaked block of a castellation. For a fateful moment he clung to it, his head and shoulders jutting over the drop. Then, with Vita and the men watching helplessly, the brickwork cracked along the base, tipped, shifted, then fell away. With a short grunt of shock and fear, Billings rolled over with it and plunged out of sight. For the space of a breath, the footmen and Vita were frozen. Then all heard the sickening impact below. Tom, on hands and knees, reached and helped Vita crawl back to the safety of the turret. Swain took her arm. The younger men ran down to raise the alarm.
Are you hurt, miss?
I don't think so. I only need to get my breath. Did he fall? Is he dead? He'll be dead, won't he? The shock was making Vita feel sick. Her hands were trembling. The sound they had both heard of Billings' body meeting the ground was still echoing in her memory. She tossed her head as if to shake it from her ears. The men will fetch help, miss. Dr. Mills has been called for already, Wayne told her, guiding her round the twisting stone stairs. Vita could only manage small thoughts. Oh, Swain, she said, my glasses. I think he destroyed them. Swain led her down to the room below and retrieved the misshapen frame of a small pair of glasses from the floor. Neither eyepiece had a lens. I am afraid you are correct there, miss. Something was troubling Vita's thoughts. It took a moment to remember, but then the feeling of panic rose sharply. I must go to the nursery, Swain. There may be a dangerous medicine there. Please, it's urgent. It must be kept from the children. We must hurry.
Come, said Swain.
He took Vita's arm and propelled her through the complicated geography of Pemberton at a speed that left Vita with only the blurry impression of staircases, passageways, and grand paintings flashing by. They burst into the nursery kitchen and found Nettie still looking tearful, making toast. Marianne and William were sitting at the table.
Nettie, is there any medicine here for the children? Vita gasped.
Nettie, standing with a toasting fork over the fire, could only gaze helplessly at them. Marianne and William looked on astonished.
Only the night-time medicine, miss, Nettie finally said. Master William has it with his cocoa if he can't sleep.
And you haven't given any to him yet, or to his sister?
No, miss, I couldn't find it. Mr. Billings brings it in a blue bottle. It's always kept up there. She pointed to a high cupboard.
Swain strode over and opened the cupboard door, but the shelf inside was empty. Vita spoke gently to the girl, who was close to tears.
Nettie, do you know what could have happened to the medicine?
Nettie now gave in to helpless weeping, lifting the hem of her apron to dab her face. Miss Hartley came, she blurted between shuddering sobs. Miss Hartley came and took it to her room.
Chapter 44. When, much later, Vita finally remembered the note and knocked on the chef's door, it opened to reveal Dr. Zecker, as well as Monsieur Picard. The chef's pantry was a small windowless storage space, crammed with packages, boxes, and jars. There was barely room for a single chair, but three had been installed. "I have asked you both here to prove my innocence," the chef declared. "I beg you to stay. I have devised a proof that there is absolutely no contamination of the seafood last night, none whatsoever."
"What is he going to do?" Zecker asked in German.
"He is overwrought, I fear. You think I am too dramatic, no? But I wish to persuade you that my seafood, the good seafood of France, is healthy and good. It harmed nobody last night."
"Ask him to calm himself, please," Dr. Zecker told Vita. "I dread some moment of madness to follow."
"Here is my proposal," said the chef. He lifted a domed cover to reveal a plate of oysters and assorted seafood. "I propose that I should eat this food taken directly from the dining table last night. I shall eat it before you and prove that I am unharmed and my health perfectly undamaged."
"The man is mad, I think," Zecker said.
"This proves nothing. This proposal is most unscientific."
"See," cried the chef, "I eat it. It is delicious and good in all ways." He swallowed two oysters in a row, cracked the head from a prawn, and tore the flesh out of its body with his teeth, chewing with exaggerated relish.
"I can eat all this and several buckets more, and still I will be in the very best of health. I swear this is the truth."
"What a performance," Zecker said. "I hope he does not expect me to sit here in this cupboard and watch him consume buckets full of shellfish. If it does not make him ill, the sight will certainly damage my own health."
"Eat some yourself, it will not harm you."
"I would give this to an invalid with absolute confidence," the chef declared, continuing to crack shells and swallow crustaceans. He waved a plate of oysters under their noses.
"I do not eat the flesh of living creatures," Zecker remarked. "It is a matter of principle."
The chef paused in his chewing.
"Not even oysters?"
he asked when Vita translated.
"No living thing," the doctor confirmed.
"No meat, no fish. He has no life at all," declared Monsieur Picard, and he continued eating shellfish from the plate.
"There were other dishes eaten last night," Vita said. "Before the seafood, there was a soup, I recall."
"A choice of two, to be precise. Mock turtle and consommé de volaille," said the chef. "I have some of both here. Do you wish me to take some soup also?"
"This is ridiculous," Zecker declared.
"It would confuse the outcome if you now consumed two soups as well. There would be no knowing which, if any of them, caused you to be ill, if you did become ill," Vita pointed out. The chef could see she was right.
"Perhaps the doctor would try the soups," he challenged.
"Certainly not. Both are made from living things," Zecker said, once the idea was translated.
"I shall take the soup, then," Vita said.
"I do not allow this," Zecker objected. "What would your aunt say to this?"
"It will be a useful part of the experiment, surely." And without waiting, Vita seized the first small cup of soup and swallowed it. She was about to take the second, when Zecker reached across, took the cup, and tossed back the soup with his eyes closed and a look of disgust.
"Why did you drink it?" Vita asked.
"Mock turtle. What is it? What is a mock turtle? I know it is a living creature and therefore against my principles, but I should like to know what sort of creature it is exactly, especially if it is to make me ill.
Zeka declared. But the mock turtle soup did not make Dr. Zeka ill. It was Vita who, only a few minutes later, had to run from the room. Chapter 45. It is a mild case, and you have a sound constitution. There is nothing to worry about, Zeka was saying an hour later. Vita had been put to bed in the yellow room. Her aunt had been told she was ill, as had their hosts. Dr. Zeka had, however, not explained the real cause of her sudden illness. You would not be saying that if I were Miss Diepenthal, she muttered. Lottie would have had a dozen footmen running about, and everyone would be wringing their hands outside the door. The doctor smiled. The strength of your irritation is a very good sign. We have proved beyond doubt that the consommé was what caused this sickness, the chef declared when shortly after he was admitted to the room. I myself am in perfect health, as you can see. The shellfish I consumed, a large quantity, was delicious. I have no ill effects whatsoever. Good for you, Vita said, but could you stop talking about the soup, please? It still came from your kitchen, Monsieur Picard. But the doctor has found that the soup, but only the consommé, Dr. Zeka showed no ill effects from the mock turtle soup, was poisoned by a malicious hand. Someone added a poison to it, Monsieur Picard declared, waving his arms as if triumphantly conducting an orchestra. What? How can you tell that? Who would do such a thing? Vita asked. While you were indisposed, Zeka said, I searched with the help of Herr Schwein through all the empty medicine bottles found in the cellar. Most had contained laudanum, but one bottle was brown and not blue. Its label was in German and had contained a very powerful purging medicine, something specifically formulated to produce the effect you so unfortunately experienced, Miss Carew. I believe it is this that caused the dramatic reaction of so many diners to the soup. Not the soup itself, cried the chef. The soup itself was good. It was excellent. Could we stop talking about the soup now, please? Vita said weakly. My kitchen is not to blame, said the chef. It is not to be held responsible. Someone maliciously poisoned my food, but before it was poisoned, it was wholesome and delicious. And now I leave you, brave Miss Carew, to recover. But as you do so, please remember that I shall always be grateful, always. Monsieur bowed and marched out of the room. Alas, things may not be as simple as he thinks, Dr. Zeka remarked. What do you mean? Asked his patient, lying back on her pillows. I have a feeling that the chef may not escape punishment, fairly or not. But why? You have proved he did nothing wrong. Dr. Zeka shook his head. It is easier to blame a chef for bad oysters than it is to explain how an emetic found its way into the soup at a grand dinner party. I believe I know who put it there, incidentally. The German doctor frowned and looked at his shoes. Of course, well, one cannot be entirely certain, he added. Who? I believe it to have been Miss von Diepenthal, the doctor said. She did not aim to kill anyone, only to disrupt the evening. Vita could only blink at him. She certainly achieved that. Zeka only raised an eyebrow. But the effect was serious on Miss von Diepenthal herself. She was badly poisoned. Again, the doctor did not reply. Hers was a serious case of poisoning, was it not? Zeka still said nothing. He looked away, appearing to take an interest in something on the mantelpiece. Dr. Zeka? The doctor looked back with an inscrutable expression.
"He is a great artist," he said, "and an actress of enormous skill. That is all I will say."
"But why? Why would she do such a thing?"
"That I cannot answer." Vita lay for a moment, looking up at the faded cherubs on the four-poster bed.
"I think I might know. I heard her talking to the Italian gentleman."
"Signor Ricci?"
"Yes. It was immediately after the engagement was announced. He told her his great sopranos were always unmarried. The public did not care for a soprano who was married, or even engaged to be married, he said. Would that be enough to make her take such extreme action?"
"Quite enough. The von Diepentals have spoken of little else but Signor Ricci for months. He is a god in their world. The main purpose in coming to England was to cultivate his acquaintance, and they were all triumphant that he accepted the invitation to come here to Pemberton Hall. Fräulein Carlotta would have been horrified to learn that he would only work with an artiste who was unmarried. Her aunts also."
"You believe that Lottie was willing to poison her fellow guests and herself in order to break off her engagement? It sounds absurd."
"You are correct, Miss Carew. It does sound unbelievable," Decker said.
"Who will you tell?"
"Nobody. What is to be gained? My theory cannot be proved. If accused, Miss Diepenthal would deny everything."
Vita gaped at the doctor, who busied himself pouring her a glass of water.
"If you tell no one, Lottie will escape unpunished, and the chef will take all the blame."
"I'm afraid he will be blamed whatever I do."
"The chef must be sacrificed in order to preserve the household's reputation. Sadly, such things are not so unusual in a grand household."
A silence fell as both contemplated this injustice. Vita sat up in bed.
"Why do you choose to work for Miss von Diepenthal and her aunts, Dr. Zecker? Surely there is more rewarding work to be found than following grand ladies from town to town?"
Zecker now occupied himself with repacking his medical bag.
"Perhaps there is, and I may seek it. I have encouraged you to pursue your interest in science, Miss Carew, or at least I hope I have. But you need also to know that science and medicine in particular is not, as we say in German, is not always a rose garden. I have had difficulties. I've worked in a hospital and there contracted a bad infection. Later, in private practice, I lost a patient. Let me only say that I lost a patient I should have been able to save, and one I cared deeply for. I had not the heart to practice for a while. Miss von Diepenthal and her aunts offered me a return to medicine, and for that I am grateful to them. But now, well, you imply there is more important work to be done, and you are quite correct. I shall not stay with them much longer."
"They will be sad to lose you, Dr. Zecker."
The doctor snapped his bag shut with a reverberating click.
"Only until they find another ridiculous tame doctor. That is what Dr. Mills called me. And he was not entirely wrong, I admit it."
Vita looked at him in surprise. He shrugged. "I understand English better than people think," he said. "Now you should rest and drink only water until your appetite returns. And one more thing. Never do that again. Never swallow anything to test if it is poisoned. Do you understand me? It is not scientific, and next time you may kill yourself."
"I promise, Doctor."
Chapter 46. After Zecker had left,
Aunt Louisa and Lady Felicity visited to say good night.
"Oh dear, this is a chilly room," Felicity exclaimed with a shudder.
"My apologies, Vita.
Now that the other guests are gone, you would be most welcome to move."
"I have become fond of the yellow room," Vita said. "Even the cherubs seem friendly now."
Lady Felicity looked doubtful.
"It used to be called the Emperor's Bed. It came from France. Napoleon is supposed to have slept in it. Not here, of course. Though personally I was never convinced. I believe it was one of Dickie's grandfather's purchases."
"And are you recovered, dear?" asked her aunt.
"Yes, I am only a little bruised and tired. It was very shocking what happened to Billings. I saw Dr. Mills return."
"He has done everything necessary. Billings died immediately," Mills said. "Nobody would have wished for him to meet such an end, but he almost killed Dickie, and the evil medicine would have killed the children. And then, of course, there is Miss Hartley."
Louisa took her friend's arm to comfort her.
"How is Lord Pemberton?" asked Vita.
"He is much more himself.
Mills said there may be lasting effects. He has been dosed with high quantities of this medicine for a long period. It may be difficult to stop."
Lady Pemberton seemed to lose the thread of her thoughts for a moment, but then she smiled at Vita and patted her hand. "The police will have to come, but not until tomorrow. Now, you need to rest, and I, for one, can take no more tonight. We shall leave you to sleep. You have been very brave, Vita. Tomorrow is soon enough to discuss these events further. Mills says Dickie should rest until the afternoon, but if you would be good enough to stay until tea time, he would like then to speak to everyone together."
The maids who opened the curtains and brought tea the next morning also carried with them a blouse and skirt to replace Vita's now battle-torn day dress.
"The mistress wanted you to have these, miss," the older one said. "We mended the rip in the sleeve of your white dress, but the lovely new evening gown will need a proper cleaning."
Vita had not given much thought to her clothes.
"How kind," she said.
"You did us a favour, miss. Nobody wanted him to lose his life, but between you and me, we're all glad to see Billings gone. Nasty piece of work he was, and free with his hands. None of us liked him."
"Breakfast is in the big dining room today." In the dining room, Vita found the cheerful bustle of a generous breakfast well underway. The children were there as well as Lord and Lady Pemberton, who even sat together. From the first moment of her arrival, Vita was surprised to find that she attracted the enthusiastic attention of every waiting footman. Swain himself walked her to her place at the table and selected her food from the chafing dishes, an honour usually accorded only to the head of the household or possibly visiting royalty. Queen Victoria, in her portrait, certainly noticed, but even she seemed less critical today. Aunt Louisa caught Vita's eye across the table and winked. The atmosphere at Pemberton Hall could hardly have been more different.
Chapter 47. "We have the day to ourselves, it seems," her aunt told her at the table.
"I shall continue to paint. Whatever the circumstances, I hate to leave a piece unfinished. It is a personal rule. Besides, I would like to be on hand for Felicity. And you, Vita, how will you pass the day?"
"I shall seek out the paintings on your list," Vita said.
Dr. Zecker looked up from his fruit salad.
"I have asked her ladyship's permission to examine the architecture of the hall.
Perhaps we could combine our activities," he suggested.
"Good idea," Aunt Louisa agreed. "But take William and Mary Ann with you. They need distraction. They cannot ride today, and they will be at loose ends."
Mary Ann, as it turned out, had an invitation from her cousin, but William agreed with enthusiasm
to accompany the German doctor and Vita. They set out first for the Folly, a picturesque ruin on the only slope that overlooked the house. It had been built to offer the ideal view of the hall, whose great width showed at its most impressive expanse from this angle. "It is a fine prospect," Dr. Zecker remarked, "though perhaps better enjoyed when the wind is less biting. I am not sure my ears will still be in place if the wind blasts them for much longer." "I wish I could speak German," William remarked. "I only know one word." "And what is your one word?" Dr. Zecker asked, in English. "Himmel," William said. "It means heaven." "That is certainly a good word," Zecker said. "Would you like another?" William was occupying himself by running up the Folly's ruined stairs and jumping off. He leapt from the fifth step and landed in the muddy grass before saying, "Yes, please." "Springen," said the doctor. "That means jump." "Springen," William said, pleased with the new addition. "Springen." And he jumped up and hurled himself down again. Driven back towards the house by the cold, they noticed a cart driving away from the house. It had trunks on it. They were too far away to see the passenger, but William seemed to know something. "We will have plain food today," he remarked. "Mama says a new chef will be coming. But until then, cook will make our food." "Her food is very good, but it is not French. She makes steak and kidney pudding. I like that very much. If I ask her, she makes roly-poly pudding with custard." "What is this roly-poly pudding?" Zecker asked him. "Sponge and jam. It is delicious. You would like it. Everyone likes it," William told him. Vita watched the cart until it was hidden by the trees on the drive. "I did nothing to help the chef," she thought with a pang. "You should not blame yourself for this," Zecker said, reading her thoughts and speaking aside. "Come, we must hide from this terrible wind and find some of those paintings indoors." William knew the paintings well, though his art appreciation was brisk, to put it mildly. He led them straight to the Shepherdess, which was number 3 on Vita's list. It was a large canvas over a fireplace in one of the reception rooms. "She doesn't look like a real shepherdess, does she?" William remarked, as the three of them stood in a row and studied it. It was true. The young woman in the painting was dressed for a fashionable party, not herding sheep. "She does not look strong either," the doctor said. "Her waist is very small, and she is pale." "Why did they paint her then?" William asked. "Shepherdesses represented innocent simplicity and the lovely countryside, I believe," Zecker told him. Vita translated. William looked unconvinced. "But what of the quality of the painting itself?" Vita asked. All three stepped forward and peered more closely at the brushwork. "I think it's too brown," William said. "I agree," said the doctor. For some reason, this made all of them laugh. "My favourite painting is Eternal Star. I'll show you that one. It's much better than this." William ran off, along a corridor and into a small sitting room. Eternal Star turned out to be an Arab stallion, painted almost life-size. The canvas dominated the room. The beautiful horse, flaring its nostrils and looking as if it might bolt at any moment, was held by a calm groom. The man looked out at the viewer with an expression of quiet pride. The horse was rolling its eye and seemed full of dangerously pent-up energy. "It is magnificent. But the horse is better painted than the man, I think," Zecker said. "Yes, that is why I like it," William agreed. "Luncheon, delicious, but in the English and not the French style, as William had predicted, interrupted their studies of art history, and afterwards Dr. Zecker led William and Vita on a brisk tour of the hall's outstanding architectural features. The shape and positioning of the windows, the plaster mouldings of fruit and flowers, the panelling, the turret, the pillared entrance with its stone steps were all visited and their architectural derivations explained. It was a cheerful afternoon. William listened with surprising curiosity as Vita translated, only pausing every now and then to jump off something or run in a circle. They were summoned to the library just as his interest began to wane. "I must take my leave," Zeka said, as they walked towards the entrance hall. "My train leaves at 4. "You will not come to hear Lord Pemberton speak to everyone?" "No. I am aware of what is likely to be said. I have an appointment this evening in London. I must say goodbye. And thank you for a pleasant day, after a rather too dramatic visit." "Thank you for your encouragement, Dr. Zeka." They shook hands, the doctor bowing as he did so. "I feel that we shall meet again, so until then," he said, and turned away. Chapter 48. Much as we all wished to put recent distressing events behind us, Lord Pemberton began, one or two matters do need to be clarified. Swain, cook, and Mrs. Parks, together with all the maids, kitchen staff, and footmen, stood to attention on one side of the room, while family and guests sat on sofas around the fireplace. "To begin with Billings," his lordship went on. "It seems he was conniving with a pharmacist and overbuying the medicines I was prescribed. The excess he sold at a profit, some of it to the unfortunate governess, Miss Hartley," his wife quietly prompted him. "Yes, Miss Hartley. Mills thinks the pharmacist sold Billings an excessively strong solution of the medicine in error. Billings either did not notice or did not understand. His reading was weak. The exact extent of his involvement in the death of the unfortunate Miss Hartley is unclear. I suspect that he recklessly supplied her with the same dangerously concentrated medicine he had